Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Dr. Kiki's Science Hour with Dr. Kiki Sanford, episode number 35 for Monday, March 1st, 2010, Making Science Matter. This episode of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is brought to you by Audible.com. To download a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/Kiki. Welcome, everybody, to Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. I'm Dr. Kiki, and joining me on the show today is Zach Ronneberg. He is a science teacher at Da Vinci High School in Davis, California. And today we are going to be talking about the fun that you can have making science matter. Now, Zach is an interesting guy. He spent much of his childhood, I've taken all of this from a bio page that KSTF, Teaching Fellowship, set up for Zach. So Zach spent much of his childhood in his father's shop tinkering and building things from spare parts. So he's a tinkerer. We like that. Including an air-powered cannon that could shoot an apple over 500 feet. That's a fun project. Your love of physics came alive in high school, and he discovered a passion for teaching while studying physics at the University of California, San Diego. After earning his MA in education from UC Berkeley, Zach student taught for a while and ended up teaching physics and earth science at Skyline High School in Oakland. He's taught in Oakland, San Mateo, and Davis, and now he's working on incorporating project-based learning on a large scale. And this year, working as a science teacher in physics and chemistry at Da Vinci High School, he is responsible for creating and implementing what is called 100% project-based physics and chemistry curriculums, which I think is really interesting. Can you tell us a little bit about how that's different from other kinds of science curriculums?
So I guess the main difference is that all of the content that I'm teaching comes through the form of a project, as the title would lead you to believe. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that if kids can put science in a context that matters to them and has some relevance to the real world, that it won't seem like sort of this nebulous list of facts that they need to memorize or equations that they just need to plug numbers into, that it will seem a lot more real to them and hopefully get them a lot more interested and make more sense and understand it better and have new ways of showing their understanding. So that's sort of the idea behind project-based learning in general, is that it's a lot more real to kids and gets a lot more kids engaged in learning rather than just trying to get a grade.
So with the project-based learning, we're talking about having the kids really get hands-on. They're getting what could be considered just experiential learning experience.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's a couple of components to it. It's very... So depending on the project, it could be very kind of real world based. Like, for instance, the project that I'm running with my physics classes right now is they're learning to do energy audits on their own home. So we're learning about efficiency and power transmission and electrical circuits. And rather than just having them mess around with light bulbs and batteries in the classroom, which I do as part of the kind of the scaffolds for them to learn concepts, they also are going into their house and measuring all of the electrical devices in their house and seeing how much power they use, and then trying to come up with some calculation of how much power their house is using on sort of a daily basis, and then extrapolating that out over a year or multiple years and looking at really how much energy are they using and what else could that energy be doing? Like if that were used to power someone's house in Eastern Europe or Nigeria, like how many houses could they power for the energy they're using just for their single family here in Davis? So there's a lot of like kind of real world stuff where they look at, you know, what are they doing in their lives that, and how does that kind of affect the larger world? And then there's some other projects that are more sort of just more classroom based. And they're sort of like challenges, that we do in the classroom that, that don't have as many ties to their life at home or life outside of school. Yeah. So there's sort of some of both.
Yeah. Have you found that, I mean, you've been through several different schools and several different school districts. Have you found that teaching, is it different from district to district? Are all of them happy if you want to do the project-based learning, or have you found a lot of differences between the different schools?
I would say that as a science teacher, there's a fair amount of autonomy, in terms of how we teach concepts. Like California sets the state standards that we have to follow and do certain topics. But being a physics teacher, I'm usually either the only physics teacher or one of two, at most schools. Only the largest schools I've been at have had two teachers. And so, there's some collaboration, but I have a lot of autonomy in how I teach. And most schools are pretty open to kind of letting me try things.
That's good.
The current school that I'm at is the whole school is project based. And so they've given me basically kind of open range to say, you know, try things. If they don't work, that's okay. We're just trying to get the best project-based program we can. And doing that 100% is a lot of work. I don't think this is my fifth year teaching. And I think my first year was probably the hardest. And this year has been the next hardest because I'm basically reinventing everything I do this year to put it in a project context.
Yeah. And is that daunting? Is going from we're teaching out of a book, we're teaching, you know, this is how it works, but you're going to just read this, study the text, study what I tell you in class, watch what I do, don't do what I do, to suddenly do what I do or make it up yourself.
Right. It's a huge change. And I would say over the 5 years that I've been teaching, I've incrementally gone towards more and more project based. It's sort of, I think I like it because it's how I learn. There is still some like traditional kind of methodology in there. Like there's lots of good stuff with traditional teaching that you keep doing. Like in the context of learning how to do an energy audit, we still do a lot of this of similar labs that we would have done in a normal physics classroom. But the end outcome is this really meaningful thing that kids know how to do at the end, rather than just like, oh, neat, I know these 10 physics concepts.
Where do you get your inspiration for the different projects? We're going to get to each of the projects a little bit later, but where does the inspiration come from?
I would say that some of it comes from my background. I grew up, my father was a contractor. And so I grew up sort of just building stuff in his shop and messing around and figuring out how things work. And so one of the projects that I've done is have kids build like a scale model of a house and then wire it with switches and lights. And that came from just my experience kind of learning how to do the electrical on a house and thinking, wow, I learned a lot in that process. And I'd love to share that with my students. And then other project ideas come from other science teachers. I'm in this group, the Knoll Science Teaching Foundation. And there's in my cohort, there's four other physics teachers. And so a lot of the projects I've worked on come from sort of these late night brainstorming sessions where we get together and are like, you know, we'd really love to build instruments in class. Like, how would we do that? Or we'd love to use stop motion animation. And so we have some crazy idea and then figure out how it's going to work within the context of our classes.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit more about this group, the Knowles Teaching Foundation, and how, I mean, it's got to be fabulous to have access to that kind of a group of people who just want to be creative and try something new.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like I was saying, being a physics teacher, there's usually either no other physics teachers or one other physics teacher at the school. And you don't necessarily have a lot of time to collaborate in the sort of normal busy day. So being part of KSTF and having these other science teaching fellows is really kind of one of the most amazing resources I've gotten in my teaching career. We meet 3 times a year, and we have conferences kind of all over the U.S. because the teachers in it are from all over the U.S. And we meet for 3 days, and we just sit down and either hash out new ideas, or we bring in video or student work from lessons we've created in the past and figure out, okay, what are kids learning? What are they not learning? How can we make them learn it better? And we really try to focus hard on like both honing our skills as an instructor, but also figuring out what kids learn and how they learn and how we can help them do that better.
Yeah. It seems like that would be just a fabulous group of people to be able to access. And I think that would be one of the benefits. Do you know how people how did you find out about it? And then how can other teachers who might be interested in it, find out more about it?
So I found out about it through a colleague when I was at Berkeley. One of the other students in my teaching credential program had joined KSTF the year before me and had told me about it and said, wow, this is a really amazing program. You really got to apply. It's really like nothing else out there, because there's no other groups of strictly science teachers that have the kind of support that they do. And so I found out about it through my friend now Bradford, who we went to grad school together, and now he lives up in Portland, but we mm-hmm. still talk all the time. And so then I applied and got in the next year. And it's a pretty rigorous application process. Like you fill out the application and you get letters of rec, and then you have a phone interview, and then you go for an in-person interview, and it's really the best science teachers in the United States are selected. And so it's a really cool group of people, because I've never been around a group of people that inspiring and that into doing what they do.
Do you think that you're having influences outside of your group? So you've met this group of people through the Knowles Science Teaching Fellowship, and you know, it's wonderful to be able to access these people and be creative and come up with new ideas and work on stuff. Do you think it's spreading out from there? So have you become points from which to spread these new ideas and ways to teach?
I think yes. And I think it's taken a while for sort of KSTF to get some recognition on a national scale. There's a lot of recognition of programs like Teach for America, mm-hmm. Or there's a few other ones that are similar. But what those really focus on is getting career changers, getting people who are, you know, engineers or lawyers or whatever, coming into and teaching for 2 years, and then really having no commitment to teaching after that. Just going, oh, we'll get you to teach for 2 years. And KSTF is really focused on the long term and getting teachers to stay in the profession.
Yeah.
And so I think now about we're 5 or 6 years into it, and there's getting to be sort of that critical number of teachers out there and they're getting to the point in their career where they're sort of the head of the departments now or leaders in their school, and are influencing other teachers at their schools and outside of their schools to try some of the things that we do in KSTF. I've heard actually from a lot of different KSTF folks that they have gotten their other science teachers to try inquiry-based labs or worked with them on rewriting some of their curriculum, or they're now leading professional development in their own schools. So I think, yeah, KSTF is just starting to have a much bigger effect on the world outside of our little conferences.
I think that's really good. Do you find, I mean, there's a lot of discussion about the state of education in America and our failing schools, and there's generally kind of a negative feeling that, at least in conversations I've had where I've just talked with people about what's going on in our schools. Do you think that with programs like this and seeing that the ideas are kind of getting fostered and pushed out to other places, other people, do you think that the sciences maybe have a little bit a better place now? Or, I mean, do you have any opinion on that?
I don't know. It's hard to say because I think there's still a sort of a general view that science, especially physics, is sort of this thing that only a small portion of high school students do, that it's sort of seen as really hard and that you have to have lots of math background to be able to be successful. And so while it is a very challenging thing to learn, I don't think it's beyond the scope of most students to be able to be successful in physics or chemistry or biology or any science. But I feel like there's still sort of that perception in schools. And I've talked to counselors about it, and they're saying, oh, yeah, I'm not going to encourage kids to take physics. And I'm like, no, I want a bigger cross-section, because right now the kids who sign up for science are sort of that small group of kids who are already interested in it.
Right. So there's a pre-selected group of people who, the kids who are kind of interested in it, they want to sign up for it, they want to do it. One of the things about Da Vinci High School, they didn't have a science program before. They weren't teaching science at all before you came in, right?
Right.
Which I find just amazing. Like, how can you have a school without science?
they did. Their students took science, but the way that it worked was that Da Vinci started as their charter school, or we're a charter school, and they started kind of as a satellite to Davis High School, and they were sort of in this corner in a bunch of portables off the corner of Davis High. And so, and they offered math and humanities. So, history, English, math, and video and film. And so any other electives, the kids would go over to Davis High and take their classes over at Davis High. And what I started hearing from my Da Vinci students was, when I would do projects at Davis High, and I'd have maybe six or seven Da Vinci kids in my class, they'd be like, "Oh man, you should come to Da Vinci. You should come teach here. You're just like a Da Vinci teacher." and I was like, "Well, that'd be excellent if you guys offered science." But when I was teaching at Davis High, they didn't. And when I had actually first moved to Davis, I had called the principal of Da Vinci and said, "Hey, I heard about your school. I'm really, really interested in teaching there, and I'd love to teach in this project-based environment." And he was like, "Yeah, we'd love to have you, but we don't offer science right now." And then this last year, Da Vinci moved to a new site, and we have more space now, and we changed the way that the charter is structured, so we're an all-inclusive high school rather than just the humanities and math. So now we have the funds and we have the space to offer our own science program and PE and foreign languages and some other electives.
A lot of things to actually allow students to become well-rounded human beings.
Yeah. And to do it all in this project-based context where the students who select to go there, for whatever reason, have decided that that's the way that they want to learn. And some go because every kid gets a laptop and they really like the technology base for it.
Right.
Some kids go because they like the social aspects of working in groups, and they like the ability to be creative and try out kind of these weird things that Da Vinci teachers let them do.
Right.
As opposed to just filling out worksheets.
Yeah, it sounds like a really neat model. Do you know if this kind of a model of school is multiplying? Are these, I mean, Davis is a pretty special place. There's a, you know, it's a university town. There are a bunch of, there are a bunch of professors who live there in the local community. It's very well educated. There's funding,
right,
because
right.
there is money in the community. Housing values are high because of the university, you know, so there are a lot of things that go into allowing a place like Davis to have a school like Da Vinci High. You know, is this something that could be implemented, or is it being implemented in other outer areas or other areas of the country even?
Yes, actually, Da Vinci is part of a network of schools called the New Tech Network.
Mm-hmm.
And it was started in Napa. I'm not sure how long ago, probably within the last 10 years or so. And that model has been spreading across the country. And now there's kind of schools all over the country. I think California still has the most, but there's some in Oregon, there's some in New Mexico, there's some in, I think, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I might be wrong about this. I might have the state wrong, but I think New Jersey is going all project based. Their entire public school system is going to go project based.
So the entire state.
Yes, they're adopting this model as a educational reform model that they're going to try to implement across the state.
I wonder how that works with local school boards and everybody kind of agreeing to that. That's got it. That's got to be a big deal.
Yeah. And I probably have the state wrong or something, but I know that it is expanding, and I think it's finally being seen as a sort of legitimate way of teaching.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like there was sort of a swing for a while towards the fundamentals, towards, you know, the three R's and just drill and kill. And I feel like right now there's sort of the swing back towards doing things that are a little more creative and allow kids to kind of do their own. I'm finding the right term right now.
Allow the kids like self-discovery, be able to find their own projects, be able to learn at their in a way that they find really interesting.
Yeah. And that there's this kind of idea called 21st century skills that a bunch of businesses have gotten together and said, here are the kind of the qualities we look for in our new hires.
Yeah.
Right now. And none of them have to do with performing well on standardized tests or being able to fill out worksheets. They're all about creativity and collaboration and knowing about being technologically literate. And so all those things are the things that we're shooting for in our curriculum, not only to get the content, but also to get these 21st century skills.
Right. And on that note, I have to take a quick break for our sponsor, a word from audible.com. Thank you to audible.com for sponsoring this hour of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. And for anyone who is watching the show now, listening to the show as a podcast, Audible is giving you a special offer for a free audiobook. If you want to try out their service, you can get one free audiobook from their over 60,000 titles of so many different genres. It's just amazing. So if you are interested in your free audiobook, you can visit audiblepodcast.com/Kiki, K-I-K-I. That's audiblepodcast.com/Kiki. And you can get a sciencey book. You can get a techie book. You can get a business book. You can download something that's escapist and will get you away from this world that we live in for just a few hours. And it's read to you. You don't have to turn any pages. All you have to do is listen. These books come in very handy for people who have long commutes or if you are heading out traveling. And for anyone interested, This Week in Science has a book club. And so I'm going to suggest as this week's book, The Earth After Us, What Legacy Will Humans Leave in the Rocks? It's by Jan Zalesiewicz. I cannot pronounce his name. I apologize for that. but the Earth after us, what legacy will humans leave in the rocks? And this book is a fascinating geological story. It's scientifically supported investigation of what would happen if humans disappeared from the Earth, and what would happen to everything that we've created, and where would it be left behind? So to download this audio book for free, if you want to try out the Audible podcast service, you can just go to audiblepodcast.com/Kiki. And that's it for this Audible sponsor message. I would like also to let you know again, this is Dr. Kiki Science Hour that you're listening to, and we are speaking with Zach Ronneberg, and he is a science teacher at Da Vinci High School in Davis, where he's working on project-based learning. And we've been talking a lot about the schools and but the philosophy that comes behind this project-based learning. But let's get down to the projects. I'm excited to hear about all of the projects that you've been working on. You mentioned at the beginning of the show the energy project that your students are working on. So if you could give us a little bit more information about, you know, what's happening with that, and how do they measure the energy? How do they know how efficient they're being or not efficient? What do they do?
Right. So the big idea behind the project is that the kids are going to try to go home and figure out how much energy they're using, and then the product that they're creating. So most projects have some sort of end product or presentation. So they'll be creating this public service announcement that's aimed at some target group that they've chosen about methods of being more energy efficient. And they'll be using some of the information they get from their own houses to do that. So to go and to do the audit on their own house, we're paired with the UC Davis Energy Efficiency Group, and they came in and did two sessions with my classes and taught them how to do an energy audit. And we looked at some things in the classroom and how much energy they use. And we have these little boxes that are maybe that big or so, and they're called a kilowatt. And you plug them into the wall, and then anything you plug into the kilowatt, it will measure how much energy is being used. And you can look at, you can look at the number of watts being used, and you can set a timer and take a number of kilowatt hours, which is an amount of energy that the device would use, or you can program in how much electricity costs, and it'll tell you how much it would cost to run this device for a certain amount of time. And then they take that information and put it into a spreadsheet and do some calculations with estimating how many hours a day they use each device and come out with some total amount of energy use. And it's kind of surprising sometimes what they find, where things like you wouldn't expect, like your TiVo box that sits there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, draws a significant amount of power. And there's really no way to get around that because it has to be on all the time. And there's very little competition in the market to make a lower power consumption one, because there's only a few major players who make these things. So there's actually some legislation right now about making set-top boxes be lower energy users, because they're such huge consumers right now, which surprised me.
Yeah, that is surprising. I don't know that a lot of people actually would be aware of that at all.
Yeah. And they take all this information and then they make this PSA. And then next week, actually, we'll be having presentations in the classroom, and we'll have folks from the Davis Energy Efficiency Group will come in, and the local newspaper is going to cover it, and some parents come in, and so we'll have this big panel that the students will have to present their PSA to the panel, and it's almost like a thesis defense. Like, yeah, it's not that huge, obviously, but they have to present their work and then field questions from the panel, and it really gets pretty intense sometimes when there's experts there and they're asking questions sort of on this expert level, because the kids the kids are so good at presenting now that they sometimes seem like experts, and the people on the panel sort of forget that they're dealing with high school kids.
And so sometimes that's a good thing in some ways. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's impressive that kids can sort of come off like that as an expert in their topic.
That's awesome. And I think, I'm sure though, that the research that they do to prepare for the presentation, that they actually do a really thorough job, and they probably do know the area fairly well in a very focused way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They generally know their topics very well. It's when you start asking them, okay, well, how does this, you know, relate to coal-fired power plants, mm-hmm. or nuclear power plants? And they're like, well, we didn't quite study that yet.
I haven't gone to graduate school yet. Hold on a couple of years. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. What? So this, that's one, it's very relevant immediately. The students have an idea immediately of their impact, like what energy they're using, the efficiency of the devices that they're using. You know, this, it's very, very immediately relevant to their lives, which I think is, that's one of the most interesting aspects of it. Others, what's another project that you're doing? Your biodiesel project seems pretty, along the energy spectrum. This is a pretty cool project as well.
Yeah, both these projects are ones that I just have started doing this year. And so they're still kind of in their infancy in terms of figuring out all the details. But right now, my chem classes are involved in making biodiesel, and basically one of the other teachers, the other science teacher at my school, has a VW Jetta that runs on vegetable oil. Uh-huh. And so she goes,
she said, I'd like your students to make me some fuel.
Yeah. Actually I kind of proposed, I was like, well, if we make some biodiesel, would you be willing to put it in your car? And she's like, okay. And so we basically started out with the students researching the feasibility of, they're going to make a proposal to the Davis City Council at the end of this about the feasibility of running the Davis fleet of diesel vehicles on biodiesel.
Wow.
And so to understand whether or not that's feasible, I wanted to get them involved in actually making biodiesel and learning sort of fundamental chemistry concepts through the process of doing that. And yeah, it's actually kind of surprised me how many different chemistry concepts come up in the process of making this biodiesel. That you look at density, you get into polarity and non-polarity, you do moles and molar mass and stoichiometry and heat of reaction. Like, mm-hmm. tomorrow we're going to be taking our biodiesel samples and burning them and doing some calorimetry and seeing how much energy comes out of the biodiesel versus straight vegetable oil.
Yeah.
So it's sort of one of those things where I feel like I jumped down a rabbit hole, and I just finding all these new things that fit in with this biodiesel project, and it's kind of exciting.
How far can you go? And so the students, are they working within the class just for this 1 year, or do you have students for multiple years? So say with this biodiesel project, are they just going to work on it for a few months and that's it? Or is this something that they can keep doing for a longer period of time, or do you just keep bringing in new people and teaching it over again?
Right now, the model is sort of a standard high school class model where it's, mm-hmm. year long, and we do more or less the same projects each year. Mm-hmm. And each time a new class comes in, you do the same or slightly different versions of the same projects. But I do have some friends. One guy lives in Indiana, and he has started doing biodiesel in his class, and the kids got so into it that they formed sort of like a biodiesel co-op.
Wow.
And made a biodiesel reactor out of an old water heater. And their school now takes the waste from their cafeteria, the waste oil, and makes biodiesel. And then I don't think it's legal to sell, but if you form a co-op, then the, mm-hmm. co-op members can use
the product. Use it. Yeah.
Right. So I would love to get something like that going, but it's because our science program is still totally in its infancy. I have no idea what sort of where those things are going
to
go.
Right. And you'll, to do something like that, you'll need a group of students who are really dedicated to it. I mean, that's the kind of thing that takes dedication.
Yes. Yeah.
You got to keep it up.
So and it's
go ahead.
Just that it's hard as a teacher to have the time after school to make that happen. So you really have to have one or two kids that are really gung-ho, mm-hmm. and they'll take on a lot of the organization. But there are things like that at our school where we started up this bike co-op where the kids that go to Da Vinci, some of them also take classes at Davis High. And so they needed a way of getting back and forth between Davis High and Da Vinci now that mm-hmm. we're separate. And so we started this bike co-op, and there's a few kids who have sort of kept this thing running where they fix up bikes and kids can check them out to ride over to Davis High. So I think at this particular school, there's a lot of opportunities for kids to become leaders and things like that.
Yeah, a lot of motivation too. So with the biodiesel project, you said they're going to be presenting on feasibility of biodiesel. What are the findings? Do you have any preliminary findings?
Right now, it looks like most groups are coming up with sort of similar conclusions that it's feasible. There's minimal engine modifications that mm-hmm. need to be done, mostly just that biodiesel can rot out rubber hoses. So if you have any rubber hoses, those need to be switched to some other kind of newer material.
Yeah.
And then finding a source. So part of the proposal might be, we're going to buy this biodiesel from some producer in Sacramento, or it might include something for, we're going to try to start up a local production and gather waste oil from all the restaurants in Davis and see how much we can make in Davis. So I think there's kids sort of going both directions with it's much more feasible to just go buy it versus, mm-hmm. hey, we should actually try to make some of this.
Right. All right. Let's move on to another project. What do you think is your favorite project that you're working on right now?
I would say my favorite project is the America's Next Top Science Rockers, which yes. has an intendedly cheesy name.
I like it though.
It's sort of meant to be a spoof on reality shows, and the premise is that you're going to be trying out for this new reality show where science students build their own instruments and basically design, build, and play their own instruments within the context of a band and perform for the class. And then they both have to have some expertise in talking about how their instrument works and how it was built, as well as be able to play it and be able to play a song well with the other band members. So they have to be in tune, and there's all kinds of challenges to making an instrument be in tune with the other groups.
Yeah. And we have a bunch of pictures that you've passed along to me here. And let me see if I can bring some of these up. Oh, and it's redirecting to Picasa. There we are. Slideshow. Let's see. See if I can bring these up. So we've got, there's somebody who made did he make his own guitar there?
Yeah, he built this amazing electric guitar that sort of just blew me away and built the entire thing from scratch.
Wow. So the kids, what are they doing there? Were they measuring some kind of electrical capacitance or something? Is there an electrical component in this?
There are some kids who choose to build electric instruments, like an electric guitar or an electric bass. Most of them are not electric, but what they're doing there is we have microphones hooked up to the computers in class, and they can use the microphone to measure the frequencies that their instrument is producing, and then use that to help tune their instruments and figure out what harmonics are being produced and overtones and. So it really gets kind of complex where they'll get really into looking at the, not just like the main frequency that they're
like that banjo.
Yeah. it kind of blows me away, the variety of instruments that kids make and some of the creativity.
And is it completely up to them what instrument they decide they're going to make?
So I give them sort of like broad categories of instruments that they might be interested in. So strings, percussion, and wind instruments are sort of the categories. But within that, they can pretty much design their instrument however they want.
I think that allows a lot of flexibility. And then at the same time, they get to learn about the principles that underlie harmonics or wind instruments versus string instruments versus, like, how do these things work? So do you actually sit down and have in-class discussions? Is it just they present how their instrument works at the end of it?
So it's about a month-long project. And the first 2 weeks they learn mostly through labs and some discussion. They learn a lot of sort of basic wave principles and learn about standing waves and traveling waves and transverse and longitudinal waves. And then once they get to actually building the instrument, they then have to take those concepts and say, okay, well, how does that play into my particular type of instrument? So it's a little bit of traditional teaching in combination with a little bit of wood shop and a little bit of engineering and some sort of some design challenges. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of amazing that kid right there was on the screen.
Yeah.
Built a saw, like a kind of traditional Southern, like,
right. The saw.
Yeah. And his challenge was that one of the requirements is you can't play it by ear. You have to have specific notes so that anyone could play it. So he had to find a way of calibrating his saw where if you put it at a certain position, it will make a certain note. And so that was a huge challenge, actually.
Yeah.
And he figured out some, like, basically that if you, where's my hand here? that if you turn the handle a certain amount, it will, for every few degrees, will change its note by a half tone or a full tone.
Right.
And then laid out a scale and was able to basically label all the notes on it. And it actually sounded pretty good.
That's so fun. And there's a video that you sent me. Can we play this of the kids? So this is a video of the kids. Let me turn up the MacBook so we actually get the volume. But some of the kids performing, what's the song they're performing?
It's Crazy Train.
Crazy Train on instruments that they created themselves. This is just,
yes.
This is just great.
Wow. Okay, well, not ready.
I have a question. Do you guys wear black on purpose?
No. We're just emo. Okay, so we're playing Crazy Train. Drums, xylophone, guitar, and vocals. So,
a little bit of stage fright.
I've been chosen to do the most embarrassing parts. So, ready? Ready? All aboard!
This is the best part.
His instrument was backwards.
Yeah.
Thank you.
That is so great. And so,
yeah,
go ahead.
They had an amazing time with that. And they spent a lot of time working on their instruments, but it came out so good, and they were so proud of it that it was totally worth it.
I'm really impressed that the guitar was completely homemade. I mean,
yeah.
That it sounded great. I mean, he was a good guitar player to begin with, but then the guitar sounded great, completely homemade. And
it still blows my mind that he was able to do that. I don't know how much time he spent, but it was a lot.
Yeah. So did you have, are they now going on a YouTube world tour or something?
Something like that. Yeah. The kid who had his xylophone backwards, he said, so I did the video and put it on YouTube, and, he said that kids around school that he didn't even know were coming up to him and just like putting their hands out like this and then doing that.
Turn it around.
Yeah.
It does matter in something like a xylophone to get your notes right.
Yes.
Which direction you have it facing. Yeah. I think that's a wonderful project. Like you said, there are so many different things that come in, different principles of physics that go into creating the instruments themselves. Another project that sounds like a lot of fun that you do is the egg drop, but it's everyone growing up does an egg drop. You try and protect your egg in a milk carton and drop it off the top of a building and keep it from splatting on the pavement below. Right.
Right.
But yours is different.
Yeah. And my issue, I have nothing against the traditional egg drop, and I've done it many times, and it's a fun thing. But the problem with it, as I see, is that kids build some neat device, and then they drop it off the roof, and then you ask them, what'd you learn? And they go, padding helps eggs not break.
Right.
Or I learned that my machine didn't work. And unfortunately, that's often the limit of sort of what they get out of that, and maybe a little bit of engineering and problem solving. So what I do is I have, instead of them building a device, they have to build a bungee cord that will get the egg as close to the ground as possible without actually hitting the ground. So they basically have to solve a problem that is, how much gravitational energy does the egg have when it gets dropped? And how much will their bungee have to stretch in order to absorb all that energy? And then they have to write a software program, but I call it software. Mm-hmm. They basically have to make an Excel spreadsheet that has formulas in it and inputs and outputs that will, because I don't tell them the drop height until the day of the drop. And so they have to test their bungee, and they know kind of how stiff it is, and they can calculate how much energy it will absorb for how much stretch it stretches. And then on the day of, I give them an egg and I tell them how high it is, and they have to plug all that information into their Excel spreadsheet.
Yeah.
And their spreadsheet should all do all the math for them if they've programmed it right. And then they actually go outside and test it, and the closer they get to the ground, the better their grade is.
The closer they get without actually touching the ground. And this is important. I mean, bungee jumping is something people do for fun now. And so these are the basic calculations that people who are putting together these bungee jump devices, these bungee jump events, they have to figure out how strong the bungee has to be. They have to figure out how many bungees. They have to figure out, use the height, the weight, like all these different parameters to actually keep people safe.
Right. And the kids, it's surprising how well they can actually tune their bungee. And I get kids within 5 or 10 centimeters of the ground on a pretty consistent basis, because they've done such careful measurements of their bungee that they know exactly how far it's going to stretch.
So we have some images here from one of your egg drop adventures. Who climbs the ladder? Is that you?
No, I have the kids go up the ladder. Of course, you have to clear that with the principal first. But one kid from each team climbs the ladder and hooks up their egg to there's like a carabiner up at the top that they hook up their egg to. And then they drop it. And we have a high-speed camera that catches the whole thing. So if there's any dispute about how close it got to the ground, we have the high-speed camera to to check it out. And then it's also just fun to watch the high speed at the end. Yeah,
I love this picture. So concerned about what's happening.
Yeah, and she was very concerned.
So the high-speed camera, that's another thing in terms of tools that science teachers can use, that technology allowing advancements in projects in the classroom. Uh-huh. Having a high-speed camera is something that would probably come in handy. This is one way it would come in handy, but I'm sure it comes in handy all sorts of places.
Yeah. It's a pretty cool tool. It's kind of gotten this cult following with physics teachers because you can capture things that you know, would normally kids wouldn't be able to see, like things exploding or ripples of milk drops in a bowl of milk, and seeing the waveforms actually move and capturing that at 300 frames a second or 1200 frames a second allows kids to analyze things they never have in the past, which is very cool.
Yeah. So do you personally do a lot of the high speed photography?
I just got the camera this year. I love my principal. He was gracious enough to give me $1,000 to buy this camera.
Wow.
And it's a Casio EX-F1. I just saw in the chat that someone was asking about that.
What is the camera that you're using? Yeah.
Yeah. And so I haven't done a ton with it, but I've had kids like bring in their paintball guns, and we've taken video of paintballs being shot and exploding, and bow and arrows, like an arrow exploding a water balloon and just hitting a target, and kind of seeing the waves travel through the arrow after it hits and seeing how it reacts to the forces of impact and stuff. So there's some cool stuff we've done.
Yeah, it sounds really neat. The other things that you've done, Rube Goldberg machines. Do you have the students design and build their own Rube Goldberg machines?
Yeah. And kids love that project.
Does it take over your classroom?
That project, actually, they build it at home because if I let them build it in the classroom, it would completely take over.
Yeah.
And then they bring the machines in, and they have what I call a trade show, basically, where they have to like hawk their machine to the rest of the crowd and try to convince them that it's the best machine. And then at the end of it, each kid gets some stocks and they get to invest in their favorite machine. And so they're sort of like a crowd favorite in terms of, which one had the most style or which one had the coolest energy transitions or something.
Right. Which one everybody wants to invest in. That's the one.
Yeah.
That's the one.
Yeah.
And here we've got, let me open up this link. There are some pictures of creating a rideable hovercraft. Mm-hmm. That sounds like an interesting project. What principles of physics does that cover?
This project actually wasn't an in-class project. It was for a competition that was put on by Intel and the Sacramento Kings.
Okay.
And so it was sort of a project to inspire young engineers to get involved in building some device. And the purpose of the device was to increase crowd participation at a Kings game. And so a bunch of Sacramento area schools all built devices, and ours was this hovercraft. And the idea was that the Kings mascot was supposed to ride around on the hovercraft, and it was like his floating throne kind of. And, there is a lot of physics involved with it, but that particular project was more just built for the engineering aspects, and we didn't think a whole lot about the physics involved because it was more for this competition.
Right. Did the kids really really seem to get involved in it and enjoy the project process?
Yeah. They had a blast, and I had a really hard time keeping my hands off of it because there was some points where I was like, oh, I just want to get in there and like, you know, put in some screws or whatever. And
I can fix this. It'll be really good.
Yeah. But I was really adamant that I was like, this is your project and here's all my tools. And I, you know, brought all my woodworking tools from home and said, taught them how to use things safely and said, you know, go for it. It's your baby. And they got up to the whiteboard and started drawing plans and were, you know, discussing whether we needed two lift fans or one lift fan and how big to make the holes on the bottom of the of the skirt in order to have optimal airflow. And so there's a lot of cool conversations coming out of it.
Yeah. And I'm sure they learned a lot in the process, just the whole thing, putting it all together.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Wow, this is, I'm just looking at this list of stuff. It just seems to go on and on. This is one fun thing after another. Now, okay, this one that I'm going to bring up right now, this is something that you did and not the kids.
Yes. Another one of my sort of fun little hobbies is building neat demonstration devices.
Yeah.
So a couple summers ago, a couple of physics teachers and myself all built these beds of nails. And so I lay on the bed of nails, and then I have another teacher or some students put another bed on top of me. And then a teacher comes and breaks a cement block on top of the bed of nails. And the kids just freak out. They love it. And
I imagine there's a lot of no way going on. Yeah. Like, are you kidding?
And they all want to like feel the nails and see if they're really sharp.
Right.
And what we end up doing is basically calculating the amount of force per nail head given, and they have to come up and like measure the area of the nail head and figure out what my weight is. And so there's some cool ideas that come out of that, but it's also just sort of fun to do like the, whoa, holy cow, kind of demonstrations in class sometimes.
Yeah. Have you ever done hot coals, walked on hot coals for your class?
Every year I have kids ask about that. Mm-hmm. And I'm always like, I don't know, maybe next year. We'll see.
really, yeah, you'll be fine. Just walk fast.
Yeah. I've seen physics teachers do it while they're like clutching a physics book and claiming that the power of physics will save them and they won't get burned as long as they're holding their physics book.
Good. That's good. Yeah, I think demonstrations like this are good in terms of teachability, but also in terms of the myth busting aspect. So teaching kids not just the principles, okay, we can figure out how much force per nail head, but actually being able to figure out the scientific process, and that when you see things, what you see is not necessarily what is actually, you know, you shouldn't believe what you see.
Right.
And that you can actually work backwards and figure out what's going on using principles of science.
Yeah. Yeah. And that if you see something that doesn't seem right, either someone is doing something to trick you that you're not seeing, or you just need to look into it a little bit deeper and say, well, what physics principles are at work here? And if this is really happening, then there must be some physics principle to explain it.
Right. Yeah. And try and get them to figure out what might be at play.
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Well, this looks like, it just looks like so much fun. I want to go back and take physics again. Like, can I go back to high school? This looks like fun.
Yeah. It's pretty awesome. Like my job, I get to like go into the classroom and do fun stuff most days. So it's, there's a lot of other stuff that isn't, you know, I'm not a huge fan of grading papers and stuff, but for the most part, my job is awesome. And I really enjoy doing it every day.
Yeah. And I think that's all we can ask for, is something that we enjoy doing every day. So,
yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this has been really fun. And I just want to say thank you so much for sharing all of the projects that you do. The one thing that we haven't gotten to yet, I almost forgot about it. Your Wiimote.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Your Wiimote. I just want to get to this really quickly, because this in terms of using interesting technology, like fun technology, and trying to create something that would normally cost a lot of money, but using more affordable supplies to be able to create something that you can use in the classroom. I think this goes a long way towards that. So if you could tell us what you did with your Wiimote.
Yeah. I'll try to give you the short version of it. Basically, I'd been sort of intrigued with this idea of having a smart board, where you basically, instead of having pens, you draw on the board and the computer picks up where the pen is and makes a computerized line instead of an ink line. Mm-hmm. But those systems cost $1,000, $2,000. And so then I'd heard about this from another science teacher, that you can basically, inside of a Wiimote is an infrared camera, and when you move the Wiimote around, it will track what's called the Wii calls it a sensor bar, but really it's a light bar. Mm-hmm. It's basically a bar that goes in front of your TV that has two infrared bulbs, and the camera in the Wiimote tracks where the bulbs are and figures out how it's moving. So you can do that backwards, where if you set a Wiimote basically on top of your projector, mm-hmm, or any place where it can see what your projector is projecting at, and then you make a pen that has a, instead of a writing tip, it has an infrared bulb, an infrared LED bulb in the tip, then the camera will see where the bulb is. And there's software that you can load on your computer that, if you have a Bluetooth computer, it will talk to the Wiimote, and the Wiimote will tell it where the bulb is, and then it works basically just like a pen, where it knows where the bulb is, and when you turn the bulb on, so you have a little switch on the pen to turn the bulb on and off. When you turn it on, it will then make a line that follows the end of the pen.
Right.
And so you can write with this thing, and you can use it as a, basically if you project your desktop up onto the screen or whatever program you're using, you can use it to control your computer. You can use it to do your PowerPoint. You can use it to do whatever normal thing you do with your projector.
That's cool. Yeah. Are there instructions on how to put something like this together that you found somewhere, or did you, or do you have these?
Yeah,
posted somewhere.
I did a lot of searching on the internet and hit a lot of dead ends. And what I tried to do was on my website, which is ronnebergscience.com. There's this, I kind of sort of tried to collate all the best resources for how to build these things that I found. And it turns out it's really not that hard. It's about $10 of parts from Radio Shack. And, but then you also need the Wiimote and you need a projector and you need a computer to run the projector. But the actual infrared pen is super cheap.
Where are you hiding it in here?
If you go to educators on the left-hand side.
Educators. There we go. Got it.
And then under links.
Wiimote smart board, overview videos, overview page. Whiteboard, Mac software. Yeah, there's a whole bunch of information there. So, pen building ideas. Interesting. This is great. So, if anybody is interested in trying to develop their own smart board with an infrared pen, this is great.
Yeah. And there are some limitations to it. It doesn't
take out the ink.
Yeah. It doesn't draw super smooth lines if you move your hand kind of slow, because I think the resolution of the Wiimote camera isn't super great. Mm-hmm. But as long as you move your hand in sort of like fluid movements somewhat quickly, it it works really well, and it can pick up individual clicks really easily. So it does... controlling your computer with it actually works pretty well.
Okay.
But writing letters and numbers is kind of not its strong point.
But I'm sure there are all sorts of applications that people can come up with to be creative with something like this.
Yeah. And people have done a lot. If you search YouTube, there's all kinds of videos about different applications that people have found for it. So there's some cool stuff.
Great. So the website is Ronneberg Science, R-O-N-N-E-B-E-R-G, science.com.
Yeah.
And there are different, the teaching project ideas, and then as well underneath the educators, there is the link there for the Wiimote. That's pretty cool. That's neat. Yeah. All right. So I think we've run about to the end of our hour. So I just want to say thank you so much for taking the time to tell us about what you're doing. And, you know, the work you're doing seems just really fun and creative. And I hope that it's inspiring a whole new generation, well, at least classroom by classroom, of inquisitive people.
I hope it is. And I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me and having me on your show.
You're welcome. So where can people, ronnebergscience.com, are there any other links that would be important? Or if people want to get in touch with you, is there any way that they should do that?
The other links I'd say are davincihigh.net and kstf.org if you'd like to find out more about the Null Science Teaching Foundation. There's links to email me on my website, ronnebergscience.com.
Great. And so here's the kstf.org website. And again, is Ronneberg Science.
Yeah.
Yeah. This has been fun. So
yeah.
Thank you very much. And yeah, I'm in Davis every once in a while, so maybe I'll see you there.
Sounds good.
Good. Well, thank you and have a wonderful evening. And this is it for Dr. Kiki's Science Hour for episode 35, Making Science Matter with Zach Ronenberg from Da Vinci High School KSTF Fellow in Davis. Signing out, I'm Dr. Kiki.